Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. After nearly 15 years and tens of millions of dollars, a group of scientists has created new life. A tiny bacterium with a completely synthetic genetic code. We're talking this hour with this organism's creator, geneticist Craig Venter, who mapped the human genetic code back in 2000 and has now moved on to the new field of synthetic biology. This hour on Point, Craig Venter on the promise and perils of life created in a lab. You can join the conversation. What's your reaction to this scientific breakthrough? Do you support the creation of synthetic life forms? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is J. Craig Venter, a geneticist and entrepreneur and a huge name in the world of science. He was one of the first to sequence the human genome back in 2000. Now he's founder and president of the J. Craig Venter Institute, a nonprofit genomics research institute, which last week announced the creation of the first synthetic cell. Craig Venter, welcome to On Point. How nice to have you.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
You describe your work as the first time a self-replicating cell has been created whose quote-unquote parent is a computer. Tell us exactly what you have done.
Well, we started by sequencing the genome, the complete genetic code of a very small bacteria, Mycoplasma mycoides. That DNA sequence went into the computer as ones and zeros. Then we've now gone the other direction. We started with those ones and zeros, made some modifications, designed and then built the over 1 million base pair chromosome, starting with four bottles of chemicals, then finally succeeded in inserting that synthetic chromosome into a recipient bacterial cell. That cell started reading the genetic code of the synthetic chromosome and converted that recipient cell into a whole new cell dictated by that synthetic chromosome. So it's the only DNA in the cell now after over a billion replication cycles is our synthetic chromosome, and all the proteins in the cell are derived from that synthetic chromosome, which is why we've defined that as a synthetic cell.
All originating from four bottles of chemicals and a computer.
Yes, but very much for this very first experiment, after all the time we've spent on it, this has not been a trivial project, trying to get it so we could move DNA across the branches of life and actually get it booted up. Of course, we started with a known cell that had a good chance of working. We eliminated 14 genes from it and added over 5,000 letters of new DNA in the form of watermarks to distinguish it from a naturally occurring genome. But this is definitely not a new life form designed from scratch. We're mimicking nature for this first proof of principle experiment.
Well, let me ask you about that, about this life from scratch, because it has been called that. This is a self-replicating synthetic cell whose DNA was chemically designed on the computer. It sounds very young Frankenstein to me. Help us better understand what exactly this cell is or is not. Is it artificial life? Have you created life from scratch?
Well, these are all definitional things, but artificial life is something that your listeners in Boston are very familiar with. It occurs within the computer, so this is definitely not artificial life. This is very much real life. This is a living, self-replicating cell that microbiologists, without using DNA sequencing, would have great difficulty distinguishing from other similar life forms. So it's definitely not artificial, but it's not a new life form. It's a new variation of Mycoplasma mycoides. It's different. It grows a little bit faster. It's missing 14 genes and has this other DNA. But we did not design a new life form from scratch. we built the chromosome from four bottles of chemicals out of the computer. This basically first experiment in this area now opens the way for that, but it's been labeled lots of different things in the press. This is definitely not life from scratch. It's DNA synthetic software out of the computer that's now booted up the first cell. But it is clearly the first cell who had its chromosome origin being a computer.
Mm-hmm. Which opens the way to other things, as you mentioned. What is the significance of this to your mind? The Wall Street Journal calls your work the beginning of a new era in biology, a turning point in the relationship between man and nature. How do you see the significance of what you've done?
Well, it's very significant to our team personally, seeing that we've been working close to 15 years on this project. This started when we sequenced the first two genomes of living cells back in 1995 and started asking questions about what basic cellular life really was and could we find out what the essential genes for life were. That question and that journey now has brought us to this point 15 years later where we now have the tools to begin to answer those questions. Really understanding which are the essential genes. And that's not a trivial question. In this very study, our final success was delayed on the order of 3 months just from having one single base deletion out of over a million letters of genetic code because it was an essential gene.
So a single typo caused the entire system to stop functioning as you were writing this code for 3 months, is that right?
That's right. We couldn't get life based on a single error. So there's parts of the genome, including parts of our genome, where we cannot tolerate any errors. And there's other parts in this simple cell's genome where we can put large insertions. That's where we put in the watermarks, labeling this as synthetic DNA into areas that we knew could be disrupted. So an important part of understanding life or understanding those genes that any disruption and any genetic change could be incompatible with life and other parts of the genome where we can make very substantial changes and have no impact on life whatsoever. So it's important for us to understand that as a means of eventually understanding our own DNA.
We'll talk about that.
A single bacterial cell, single mammalian cell, where we understand what all the genes do, what their function is. So our knowledge is still very primitive. This gives us a very exciting to us new tool set to begin to answer some of those questions.
So moving away a little bit from the scientific speak, what are the real-time applications for this work, synthetic cell, self-replicating cell? What are the real-time applications for the average person listening right now?
Well, for the average person, perhaps equally important with anything that might be built from it is just understanding better definitions of life. When we look at cells, when we look at organisms, we sort of see what to our eye look like fixed entities. When we look at them through the dynamics of adding a new synthetic chromosome to the cell, the cells immediately start reading that new software, immediately start making new proteins, and evolve into a new derivative species. We change second to second in our cells, and we are software-driven machines, and the software is DNA. You take that software away, the cells die very quickly. You change the software and the cells convert into whatever that software makes. I think conceptually, that's an important expanded view of our understanding of life, but it creates a tool that probably will have impact in multiple fields. Probably the first thing that people will see that directly affects their lives other than the conceptual changes is the vaccine for flu that you get next year could potentially come from our new processes. We can literally build a new vaccine candidate in less than 24 hours versus all the time that we heard last year to get new vaccines out for H1N1. So it's a very powerful tool that allows us to do things that we only wish we could do a short time ago.
Not just new vaccines, but clean water applications as well.
Well, we think that biology has a chance to be a very significant player in this next stage of human life on our planet, when we're going to go from 6.8 to 9 billion people over the next 30 or 40 years. And we have trouble providing food, clean water, health care, and energy to those 6.8 billion people. We need wonderful new scientific advances to be able to provide all those things as we grow to 9 billion people. We think this tool set in biology will be one of the types of solutions that we have to these issues.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about synthetic biology and synthetic life this hour. With us today is Craig Venter, a big name in the world of science and the creator of the first synthetic cell. Let's get a listener question in here right at the top. Montague is calling from Rock Hill, South Carolina. Hi, Montague. Welcome to On Point.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Yes, I was wondering, would this be considered a new organism cell, or would you actually call this a synthetic clone of sorts? And thanks for taking my call. Take it off the air.
Montague, thanks. Craig Venter. So
the best way to describe it is probably a new strain of Mycoplasma mycoides. If microbiologists were looking at this cell, the only way they would be able to tell that it's dramatically new is by sequencing its genetic code. It grows a little bit faster than the wild-type strain, and it will have some other changes due to the 14 genes we've deleted. But it's not a new species other than as characterized by its genetic code. So if you sequenced its genome, you would clearly know that this was a genome made synthetically because it has 46 names written into the genetic code. It has its own website built into the genetic code and even a code for decoding this new information. The chances of that occurring naturally is close to zero.
A lot of questions, Craig Venter, about the uses of this new synthetic cell from listeners both at our website and callers here. Let's get another one from Jason in Ames, Iowa. Hi, Jason. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I had two questions, actually. One, if you can actually change the actual structure with the DNA and the genes there, is it possible to kind of engineer people to be or animals to be resistant to certain kinds of bacteria and viruses? And my second question was, what kind of implications do you think this has for evolution and those that are opposed to evolution when you're able to synthetically create another strain of bacteria?
Jason, thank you. First question, the resistance to virus and perhaps even curing diseases.
Well, it's a very long way, Jason, to go from what we're doing with very small bacteria to very complex species, including humans. And we have no desire or design to go in that direction. But your question is very applicable to these small bacteria, and it's very important when we think of new strains of algae trying to create billions of gallons of fuel. We know from all our work in the oceans that the major way that these algae are controlled in the oceans is through viral attacks. So that would have a huge impact on the economics of a future facility if 40% of the cells were always attacked by viruses. So the scientists in this field think by making some simple changes in the genetic code, we can make these organisms completely viral resistant. So it's an interesting concept as we go forward.
And the implications to the idea of evolution was Jason's second question.
Well, it's hard for me as a scientist who views evolution clearly now as an established fact from having the genetic code of every type of species on the planet and seeing how we're all related. I think this study, in fact, shows what happened early on with evolution. People talk about how You can't get to complex functions with just single genetic changes. But when we look at the transplantation we did with the synthetic chromosome and then look back at natural organisms, we see evidence that this has taken place many times throughout history. We find multiple organisms that have more than one type of bacterial chromosome. Cholera, perhaps, is the best example. Scientists thought there was only a single chromosome in cholera and that it was related to E. coli. When we sequenced the genome, we actually found two different chromosomes, and they were different in structure from each other. So it's very likely that cholera evolved as either by a fusion of two bacterial cells or by a similar process we use with the transplantation. It took up the DNA from another cell and became a new species, adding instantly over 1,000 new traits. We've seen cells where multiple thousands of new traits would have been instantly added to a cell. So I think this tells us perhaps a great deal about evolution.
What about the moral and the ethical implications of all this, Craig Venter? President Obama asked the White House Bioethics Commission just last week to complete a study on the issues raised by synthetic biology and your work. He says your work raises, quote, genuine concerns. The Catholic Church calls your creation of the first synthetic living cell devastating, says you're playing God. So from the White House to the Vatican, I'm curious of your response.
Well, actually, the Vatican said something quite different than that. They expressed cautious optimism about this new technique and its applications and implications for the future. And we're only concerned if this was extended to humans. So I think you need to go check your reference on the Vatican there. But
I'm actually looking at a Wire story that says we look at the science with great interest, but it must always measure up to ethical standards, which currently do not exist. Humans must never be pretend to be God by artificially creating life. Life comes from God, and it goes on and on.
Yeah. So just to remind people, there's a 15-year history in this field, and we asked for a bioethical review before we did the first experiments. We actually asked Art Kaplan, who I understand you're going to have on shortly, and
yes,
his team at the University of Pennsylvania to undertake a review of the question about synthesizing new life in the laboratory. They published their results in Science in 1999, and then there's been continuous review of this process since that time, including in the federal government, studies funded by the Sloan Foundation at MIT and at my institute that people can find at jcvi.org and other places where it's been published. So we've been asking these questions first and before anybody else has, and we're trying to drive the ethical and the policy discussion along with the scientific advances. I think this is certainly one of the first times in science where the discussion took place before the experiments and is ongoing.
Do you worry about creating something that you can't control?
We welcome the bioethics debate and discussion by the President's Commission. I think that's an excellent idea. And you know, the discussion on this has obviously been increased dramatically by our press announcement and our publication in Science, and exposing people who don't follow the science and the discussions. This is their first exposure to these issues, but they're not the first time they've been discussed. In fact, in 1967, President Johnson, in discussing Arthur Kornberg's work on replicating the PHI-X174 genome, this was before even the DNA sequence was known. People referred to it as creating life in a test tube. So these discussions have been going on for decades. Your question, do we worry about things getting out of the lab? Repeat your question, please.
Do you worry about creating something you can't control?
Well, this has been an issue about molecular biology since the earliest stages, and this was all brought to a head several decades ago at the Asilomar Conference. There's probably been tens of millions of molecular biology experiments done with putting genes from every species into the bacteria E. coli with no negative impact at all, in part because of the care that scientists take with this and the recombinant DNA guidelines out of NIH that apply to our work as well, but also because the E. coli was designed not to survive if it escaped from the laboratory, got put down the drain, or even deliberately released. It could not survive. We believe that's an important part of synthetic genomics, is to build in traits to the cells, suicide genes, and chemical dependencies where they can't possibly survive out of the production facility or outside of the laboratory where they've been created. So we think that's a very important aspect of this, and it's quite often the first or second question I get over the last decade speaking about this work around the world.
Let me bring another voice into the conversation. With me now from Chicago is Art Kaplan, of whom you made a reference. He's a professor of bioethics and director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. He writes the Breaking Bioethics column for MSNBC. Art Kaplan, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So how do you view synthetic biology and Craig Venter's creation of this living replicating cell whose parent, he says, is a computer?
Well, first, I think he deserves a tremendous amount of praise and acknowledgement of the achievement. I've seen a few people saying, well, you know, you kind of built a long chromosome and stuck it into some already existing protoplasm. I'm not impressed. Let me say, I'm impressed. I've been watching the science for about a decade now, and to make non-living parts come to life, I think, is a major achievement. Not only does it open the door toward, as you've been discussing, some of the design of the microbial world to serve our purposes, but it also philosophically pushes the notion that some sort of vital force or special force is necessary to understand life itself. I think this achievement kind of refutes that and basically says it is possible to understand what makes life tick in a more reductionist, mechanistic way.
So to your mind, what are the moral and ethical implications of this?
Well, I think the big moral implication is not just the application and the dangers, the risk and benefit, although they're certainly there, but the big one is the view of life itself. As I said, when you start to be able to figure out your million base pairs and order them up the right way and then transfer them into a dead husk of another microbe's cell and have the thing fire up and do everything that a bacteria is supposed to do, you have, in a sense, brought to an end maybe 3,000 years of debate among philosophers and biologists about what is life. You're basically saying it's something that's under the control of a set of coded instructions. If you have the right chemistry around it, you can make things come to life. That's a pretty amazing demonstration and a pretty important moment in the history of science. So in that sense, understanding life, understanding how it works, seeing that you can even create it and manipulate it, I don't want to push that into the background. To me, that's major. On the risk-benefit side, as Craig has been saying, you know, I think there are all kinds of things that can be done with these microbes. Certainly the three big risk factors are, one, bioterror; two, escape out of the lab where things are being made; three, commercial entities not being able to control release into the general environment down the road when we really start making these things do what we want in a serious way. I happen to believe that each one of those is manageable, but they are concerns.
So this is not just a scientific breakthrough, as you're saying. This is a philosophical paradigm shift in this area. Is there, we're going to be thinking a different way about this as we embark upon this brave new world?
I think we will. I think if you look back again, all the way back to Aristotle, all the way up to Pasteur, while most biologists today, most molecular biologists would say, well, of course you can reduce life to a molecular understanding and an information systems notion. I think in the public attitudes and lay attitudes and religious attitudes, there's always been some notion that the line between the living and the dead, the organic and the inorganic, is somehow an ineffable mystery. We can't crack it. We can't understand it. We're never going to be able to really fully comprehend what's going on, and I don't think that's true. I wouldn't say that Gibson, Inventor, and that team have cracked all the mystery, but that demonstration that they could make a bacteria come alive and figure out the sequence to do it puts you on the road that says we will be able to pull apart the ingredients of life, artificially synthesize the whole thing someday, and that there's no mysterious force out there, no ineffability. Some people said, doesn't that make life somehow less worth respect or dignity? And I would say, absolutely not. It's still possible to be in awe that things all around us are alive and at the same time say, but we understand how it works.
Let's take another call here from Attleboro, Massachusetts. Vern is on the line. Hi, Vern. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thank you for having me. What an honor to be on the show.
Thank you.
My name is Reverend Vern Wright, and I serve open-minded, reason-friendly Christian congregations. And I was wondering if your guest might be able to answer a simple question. What do you think may be the theological implications of this fantastic breakthrough?
Vern, thank you. Art Kaplan, you first.
Yeah. Let's see. We have about 12 or 14 hours to go through that. So the theological implications. Well, in a nutshell, I think some felt that part of the existence of God or a divine entity rests on the idea that only God can make life. Some might argue that life is a mystery only comprehensible by an omniscient divinity, godlike figure. I don't think either of those claims is going to stand up to the creation of a synthetic bacteria. And you know, people have joked and said, well, does that make Craig Venter more godlike? No, but I think what it does show is that generation after generation of work in trying to understand the molecular and biochemical basis of life is really delivering the formula, and that if we want to have faith or if we want to posit belief in a God, it isn't really just the mystery. Sometimes it's the understanding of the complexity, the organization, how it works. I think at the end of the day, theology can live very easily with the creation of synthetic life, can live even with the understanding of basic life processes. It has to put its faith in the purposes to which all this is put, and the ability, if you will, to remain still amazed that it can happen at all.
What's the future of synthetic biology as it relates to your perspective on this, or bioethics?
Well, it's been it's been very good for bioethics. It's a kind of a little full employment act for bioethics, so useful in that regard. But more seriously, if you look down the road, we have some huge, enormous problems that we're facing. Not enough food, too much pollution, many diseases. If we could get synthetic biology going, make microbes our friends and have them do what we want, I think they actually will turn out to be some of the solutions to some of the biggest challenges we have.
Art Kaplan, I know you have to run. Thank you so much. Art Kaplan is director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the potential and the pitfalls of synthetic life this hour. We're joined this hour by Craig Venter, director of the J. Craig Venter Institute, which last week announced the creation of a synthetic cell. Last night, Nobel Prize-winning scientist John Sulston, who has clashed with Craig Venter in the past over issues of patenting genes, spoke with the BBC Radio about the Venter Institute's development. He dismissed the significance of this experiment, and he criticized Venter for using it as a means to gain patents and control future research.
They are using this really rather pretty little experiment, but not one of major importance in itself, to claim an enormous range of possibilities which really would give them control of all bioengineering into the future. And it seems to me that this is exactly the sort of thing we don't want the patent system to do.
And to that point, a comment from Twitter from listener Yar, who says, I'm not bothered by Craig Venter's making a self-replicating cell, but I don't think self-replicating DNA should be patented. Life should not be owned. I believe life should be free of patents. Once it becomes self-replicating, the replication is no longer controlled by the patent holder. So, Craig Venter, what's your response to all that?
Well, the nice thing of what we had hoped for with our publication in Science, as Art Kaplan alluded to, this presents a new philosophical approach to science and understanding what's possible. And we've seen a wide range of opinions and from experts and non-experts. So it's been bringing people out of in this case, out of retirement to talk about things. So, look, these are important parts of the dialogue. We're pleased to have people engaged in them. And I think it's an important part of policy making going forward of what the right approach is, what's the right thing for people to do.
Here's Joan calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Joan. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead.
Joan. I'd like to sound a little bit of an alarm about self-replicating cells.
Mm-hmm. What's your concern, Joan?
My concern is, what about when you have like an E. coli outbreak and everybody dies from it? And ordinarily, you would imagine that the E. coli is destroyed after it's killed everybody. This one self-replicates and mutates and changes into something harder and more durable and less eradicable. We've seen it happen time and time again.
It's a good practical question, John. Let me put it to J. Craig Venter. Can a man-made bacterium mutate, and how easily might it escape from a lab sci-fi style?
So, Joan, thank you for your question. I think it's asking an awful lot of science to be able to even design and replicate something as complex as E. coli, with its over 5,000 genes and very complex regulation. So there are a variety of strains of E. coli, some that do cause disease in humans. The E. coli that's used in the laboratory for the past multiple decades is a unique laboratory strain that's designed that it can't live outside of the lab. It's under constant selective pressure, so even if it does mutate, as all DNA does. So your DNA is mutating constantly if you're exposed to sunshine or chemicals or any type of radiation. That's a real part of life, that DNA does mutate. And so it is important that the controls be built in, as we've done with laboratory E. coli, into any new synthetic organism so it can't survive outside of the lab. And having multiple layers of that protection, we agree, is an essential aspect of this.
Here's a comment from our website, Craig Venter. This listener asks, as far as bioethics is concerned, good luck. We've never been able to control or make humans rational. Humans are too crazy and now are becoming too smart for their own good. No, knowledge always spreads. Technology will always be used in negative ways. Oil will spill. He's referring to, obviously, to the oil leak gushing into the Gulf of Mexico. A lot of questions about that from our listeners. You're in partnership with Exxon and BP, to say, right out of the gate. But how might synthetic biology tackle such a problem as we're seeing in the Gulf right now?
Well, in fact, I agree in part with the listener. I think what we're seeing in the Gulf is a constant reminder, and a very serious one, of the problems of taking carbon out of the ground. We don't see carbon dioxide, but seeing that oil in the water and on the beaches is a reminder of the damage that can be done to the environment. We need new solutions to wean us off oil before we completely destroy our environment. So, to the listener, I'd say without modern science and without new scientific tools, as we expand our population and expand the number of people using oil, burning oil, increasing the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, dying from new emerging infections, we need new tools in science to try and combat these. We think that synthetic biology offers one of the potential solutions to the multiple solutions we're going to need if we're going to survive long-term on this planet.
Here's another call. Craig Venter from Columbia, South Carolina. Marshall is on the line. Hi, Marshall. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, just a real quick question. Mm-hmm. I understand that you're usually just dealing with a basic bacteria. I was wondering, how long in your research from now would it take you to be able to change traits of a certain strain of bacteria to, say, live in a Martian environment, create a byproduct of that bacteria would be to create oxygen or create hydrogen, to where you can literally terraform a whole planet just with basic bacteria.
Produce whatever byproduct you want. Marshall, thank you. Craig Venter?
Marshall, thanks for your call. It's an intriguing idea. I'm pretty confident as we look closer at Mars, we will find that there are microbes there. We live on a microbe planet. There's a million bacteria per milliliter microbes in every bit of the ocean. We have 10 million viruses per milliliter. We're all breathing in and out bacteria and viruses constantly. We have more bacteria in our body than we have human cells. We have on the order of 200 trillion bacteria in our cells, in our own body. So we are in a bacterial universe. There's been questions from some people in NASA, could we design microbes that would enable long-term space flight by regenerating oxygen or destroying waste products such as carbon dioxide? So I think this is one of those intriguing areas, perhaps like the early electronics industry, where we have some basic tools and we're limited more by our imaginations right now. And I think there'll be some very exciting solutions that new young scientists come up with in the future.
Here's a listener from our website who asks, Andrew John Margonaut asks, could Craig Venter clarify his statement that he sees this work as philosophically significant, and more significantly, how it will help us hone our understanding of life as he claims it has for him?
Well, I think we touched on that a little bit earlier, and I certainly with some of the comments that Art Kaplan made, but it certainly changed my view of the definition of life and how dynamic the cells are, and that we are biological machines driven by software. Obviously, the simple bacteria we're dealing with are several orders of magnitude simpler than our own complex cells. But by changing the software and getting instant changes to convert one cell species into another just shows how dynamic life is, and understanding that we are software driven and DNA is the software of life, I think has certain implications as we try to understand human disease, human evolution, etc.
Here's a question to that point from Brattleboro, Vermont. Jerry is on the line. Hi, Jerry. Welcome to On Point.
Yeah, hi, Jane. Look, this is a quick one, but it may be twofold. What is this current study doing to help current diseases? Because it appears to me that people and scientists need to cure what is currently the big problem. We are sending our young and finest cancer researchers to Cuba, and they're being supported by their funds. I mean, do we have to end up outsourcing others, or can we have people here at home do what is necessary?
Jerry, thank you. Craig Venter?
Well, it's a complex question. I assume the listener is asking why all science on the planet's not focused on cancer. I think what's been shown over and over again in science is when people make basic science discoveries, they have implications in areas far beyond anything that was imagined or intended. I think understanding how DNA controls cells, certainly has implications in understanding cancer. Research in this country, as in much of the world, is limited by the source of funding and what scientists can get funding to study the applications. Hopefully, applications of this technology in cancer will be one of the new fields that now opens up.
Here's a question from our Twitter site. Could your synthetic cells, Craig Venter, theoretically replace defective natural cells in the body?
Well, I think, again, the leap from these tiny microbes to humans is much more a leap in orders of magnitude and in an imagination, which is good, but the science from going to a simple bacteria without much gene regulation to the immense complexity of our human cells is not something that we envision happening anytime in the near future.
Do you see it happening in generations down the road? Is it 10 years, 15 years, 100 years? Could you put a timetable on
it? One of the notions that came out of our sequencing of the human genome 10 years ago was people immediately jumped to, well, if we understand the errors in the genetic code, we just go in and fix them and replace them. And obviously, such experiments bring up, I think, far more complex ethical and moral dilemmas than anything with simple bacteria cells at this stage. And the technology has been extremely challenging to scientists because we don't have just one cell like this bacteria has. We have 100 trillion cells. And the experiments have shown that it's very difficult to get the correct gene in all the necessary cells under the correct regulation. Perhaps these tools of synthesizing DNA and moving it around will give the gene therapist some new approaches to try and do that. But I'm not optimistic about anything happening really fast in that field.
Here's Ryan from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Ryan. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you for answering the call.
Mm-hmm.
We are in biology class, and we just had a quick question for you. At what point did you realize in the 15 years that you've been working that you have succeeded or were successful?
Ryan, thank you. From a budding geneticist, biologist, Craig Venter.
Well, in this experiment, it was remarkably clear. We probably had 99 failures for every experiment that worked. Dan Gibson and the team would do the genome transplants on Friday, and then with the rapid growth, if it worked, Monday morning, there would be bright blue colonies growing on a plate. After several rounds of failure, Dan Gibson went in early Monday morning about a month ago, and I got a text message at 6 a.m. saying, I think we finally got it. Mm. So in this case, it was very clear-cut. It was a yes-no answer. And upon looking at these new blue cells and sequencing their DNA, it was clear that these were the first synthetic cells.
And when you got that text at 6 a.m., what was your reaction? What was going on in your mind when you realized exactly what you had done?
I think with the team, because we've been working so hard on this for so long and overcoming so many problems to get to this stage, the initial response was one more of a relief than of excitement. But as we got the DNA characterized, obviously we feel as a team tremendous excitement after striving for this breakthrough for such a long time.
Back in 1995, when you decoded the first genome in history, was this the next logical step for you to create a synthetic cell, and what might be next?
Well, it came out of, in fact, the first two genomes that we did. The second genome was Mycoplasma genitalium, which still has the smallest number of genes for a self-replicating bacteria, only about 500 genes. And back around the same time is when NASA scientists claimed that they had discovered fossils of what might be nanobacteria from a Martian meteor. And so it brought up a lot of discussions at the time about what might be the minimal life form that could exist, and could there be nanobacteria? And so we started asking questions what the smallest gene complement of a self-replicating life form could be. And that's what's driven us this 15-year process, in part because these are new tools that we had to develop to answer these questions. The existing tools in molecular biology for most cells don't allow you to modify more than one or two genes at a time. So to take out hundreds of genes it would not be possible without being able to make the chromosome synthetically. So that was the origin of this project. And once we started down the route of needing to get to a synthetic chromosome, obviously all these other implications over the 15 years came to mind.
Well, J. Craig Venter is founder and president of the Venter Institute, a nonprofit genomics research institute which announced the creation of the first synthetic cell just last week. Thank you very much, Craig.
Nice talking to you.
You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.